To date, our investigation has uncovered evidence that Lee Chatfield used various different schemes to embezzle, steal, and convert both private and public monies to fund a lavish lifestyle that a state salary could not possibly afford.
That was yesterday, and Attorney General Dana Nessel unveiling 13 criminal charges against former House Speaker Lee Chatfield. What did he spend money on? Well, paying off personal credit cards, went to wineries, luxury retail stores, among other things. Let's bring in the author of this article at the Detroit News, Craig Mauger. Welcome. Good morning.
Hey, thank you all for having me.
This is a big deal, and this is wide-reaching when it comes to how he spent money from the nonprofit. Explain.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big deal for two main reasons. One, just what it is. I mean, this is a former Speaker of the Michigan House, the top person in the Michigan House, someone who was viewed as a rising star in Republican politics, being charged with 13 criminal counts here that he embezzled money from his nonprofit fundraising account, that he misused campaign money by giving checks to staff and associates and then taking kickbacks from them, a portion of the checks, taking the money back and using it for personal things, and that he turned in faulty mileage reimbursements to the state of Michigan, basically stealing money from taxpayers. So there are a lot of allegations here, there. And the second thing is, I mean, this is a reckoning for Lansing that's been coming for a while. We've seen at least 9 people in and around state politics now be charged over the last 13 months. And the question is, are lawmakers here going to do anything about this?
It's interesting. His attorneys have kind of taken a page out of President Trump's playbook. He says this is a baseless attack on a prodigious fundraiser for Republican candidates by a Democratic attorney general. Part of that may be true, but are Republicans standing with Lee Chatfield here? It seems like they've been awfully silent on this.
No, you're not hearing Republicans rally around Lee Chatfield, and that's not surprising because there were a lot of people in GOP politics in Michigan who criticized him and who took note of the fact that there were session days when he was speaker where they just didn't have session because he was traveling, and he didn't really provide them any other explanation of that. A lot of the people who were kind of the first whistleblowers noting that something was going strange with Lee were people in his own caucus within the House GOP. I talked to a number of Republicans yesterday, and they're cautious with it. They say, we want to see Dana Nessel, the attorney general, prove her case. But if he violated the public's trust, he should be punished. And you're not seeing what you saw with Trump, people coming to his side and defending him from the moment charges were announced.
Craig, the investigation into Lee Chatfield initially was sparked by accusations of that sexual assault, alleged sexual assault made by his sister-in-law. How did this investigation kind of evolve into the financial crimes? Do we know?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, this started at the beginning of January of 2022 when Rebecca Chatfield, Lee's sister-in-law, came to police and said that, you know, she had been sexually abused by Lee Chatfield, according to her, beginning when she was 15 years old. Lee said it was a consensual affair that he had with his sister-in-law. But the information that she gave to investigators and some of the other family members gave to investigators indicated that there was something inappropriate happening with the campaign money. She indicated that he was converting money to cash, taking campaign funds, taking nonprofit funds, and essentially going to the ATM and getting cash out. When you get cash out from those type of funds, tracing the money becomes very difficult. And all of the disclosure requirements that we have are based around being able to track the money. So I think that gave investigators the willingness and the legal ability to begin looking at how was he using this money? Where did the money actually go?
You know, we were supposed to have greater abilities to track money. And to some extent, our elected officials are complying with this new financial disclosure mandate, but they're only telling us how much money they have. We don't know where it's invested. We can't spot the conflicts of interest. Are you as frustrated as I am about these disclosure mandates not going far enough?
You know, I try not to get frustrated. I try just to focus on what the truth is. And the truth, again, here, I don't know if people fully comprehend this, is that we have a system in Michigan where our office holders can accept six-figure checks from political donors, from people who are interested in the policies before them. There's no disclosure of the transaction, and there is no disclosure of what our lawmakers are doing with that money once they get it. We have a campaign finance system that is about money that's used in elections. We have an entirely different system without any disclosure through these nonprofit accounts, and it should surprise no one that there are potentially an alleged criminal act happening when there is absolutely no sunlight into the movement of hundreds of thousands of dollars in Lansing.
We also wanted to ask you about the Whitmer Refugee Rental Aid Program and how Donald Trump and others have said it's going to illegal immigrants. But Whitmer said Monday she opposes it for that use and that so far it's gone to refugees.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks for asking about that. That's become a major issue in the last couple of weeks in Michigan politics. Donald Trump and others have said that in the eligibility requirements for this newcomer rental subsidy, they see a chance for someone who is in the country illegally to benefit from rental assistance provided essentially by taxpayers. What we have been able to find and dig out from the data that the state has collected and the federal government has collected that is that the people who are benefiting from this program right now are in the country legally. They're primarily refugees, a lot of people from Afghanistan, and they're here legally from the immigration status that has been provided to us for these individuals. The state, as you noted, Governor Whitmer said she does not even believe that people in the country illegally should get public assistance. So that's kind of where things stand on that right now.
But, Craig, I mean, there's kind of a gray area there, isn't there? I mean, if someone is applying for asylum and they're awaiting a decision on that, aren't they technically in the country legally and couldn't they come in under that wire?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would answer it this way. No one with a pending asylum application, according to the state, is benefiting from this program right now. When we have pressed them and we have spent many days pressing them on this, trying to get a direct answer as to what policy is preventing someone with a pending asylum claim from getting the benefits of this program, they have indicated that they have some type of internal standard that's not written in the eligibility requirements where people with defensive asylum claims won't benefit. They have not come out and directly explained what that is. So all we can kind of say at this moment is that it doesn't appear anyone with that status is benefiting, and they are indicating that they won't let someone with that status benefit. So we're going to have to keep a very close eye on this.
Well, and Republicans are.
I know in Michigan, House Minority Leader Matt Hall has called for an audit of the subsidy program. But what do you think the objectives are of that proposal, and what are they hoping to achieve by doing that audit?
Yeah, the Auditor General has the ability to get personal identifying information to examine that data. That's data that's not subject to the Open Records Act that I could access. He could look at the names of all these individuals. He could really investigate what all of these individuals' personal immigration status are. What are the internal policies that maybe the state has not put out publicly? He could find all of that, and he could probably get to the bottom of it pretty quickly.
Craig Mauger, we appreciate your digging always in the Detroit News. Read his article, front page today. Thank you, Craig.
Hey, thanks for having me. Have a great day.
You too. The Supreme Court seemed weary of letting prosecutors use federal obstruction law to charge hundreds of rioters in the Capitol attack. We're going to ask Matthew Schneider his opinion on what he heard yesterday from the Supreme Court.
Now time for this week's S&P Global Mobility Minute. Here's Tom Libby, brought to you by Dana. Dana, people finding a better way.
Among the six or seven new EV brands that have come on the U.S. new vehicle market in the last couple of years, excluding Tesla, which has been around for over 10 years, Rivian seems to be in the strongest position based on several data points from S&P Global Mobility new registration data. Looking at market share within the EV space in the past 12 months, Rivian ranks number six overall, but number one among these new brands. Its share of the EV market has grown from 2.3% in the prior year to 3.5% in the most recent 12 months, and its sales volume has more than doubled to almost 36,000 EVs. The core of Rivian's success has been the R1S luxury sport utility, which ranks number eight among all EVs in the most recent 12 months, and its sales have grown almost tenfold to 26,833 units. Thus far, Rivian also has done a good job of appealing to Tesla owners, 28% of all Rivian buyers in the past 12 months had a Tesla in the garage, a far higher percentage than coming from any other brand. I'm Tom Libby with this week's Automotive Minute from S&P Global Mobility, formerly IHS Markit.